Well, I'm Stephanie Hemphill. I'm a reporter at Minnesota Public Radio and by no means an expert on wolves or the Endangered Species Act, but I've been cramming in the last couple of days reading Adrian Wiedemann's excellent book about the recovery of the wolves in the Great Lakes region. And our topic today is wolves and the Endangered Species Act. And on our panel, we have Bob Irvin, who's the Senior Vice President for Conservation Programs at Defenders of Wildlife, and Adrian Wiedemann, who's a mammalian ecologist and conservation biologist at the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and David Radaich, who's been kind enough to drive over here from northern Minnesota, and he's a farmer and rancher in Wolf Country, and is going to share some of his experiences. There's more bios in your packet, so we're not going to go into any more detail on that right now. And we thought we'd give each person about 2-3 minutes to talk about why they're here, explain a little bit about what they're about wolves, and then I'll ask a few questions, and then we'll have a good long time for audience questions. And during the audience questions, SEJ members get to ask questions first, apparently, and you should identify yourself, and then I'll repeat your question for the tape, and we don't want to encourage you to make a speech. We just want to have a question for the panel. And then that's the way it's going to go. Okay? So let us start, if you don't mind, David, by telling us about yourself and why you're here today.
Good morning. My name is David Radaich. I'm a beef cattle producer from northeast Minnesota. I live in Goodland, Minnesota. If you remember your geography from the past, and because we're talking about wolves, Lake Superior looks like the head of a wolf. And if you look at the point of the wolf, or the nose of the wolf, kind of points right to my area in northeast Minnesota. My dad dealt with wolves, and I have dealt with wolves. My dad's philosophy was to shoot them because they were a problem. I've had to do things a little more differently. I try to be legal and moral and try to deal with nature in dealing with the wolves. It's a challenge, and the challenge seems to be increasing more in the past couple of years for me. We've been quite successful at it. We have about 300 beef cows. We have Angus cows. And as it goes, every spring, April, May, we have our calves are born. And things that we live in nature and we live in northeast Minnesota, we have wolf depredation. Wolves are plentiful in northeast Minnesota. In Minnesota, we have two winters ago, the count was 2,500 wolves. I believe it has greatly increased. I think that the deer population in Minnesota is so great that when you think about supply and demand, more deer equals more wolves. And so under that thinking, I just noticed that we've had more activity lately with wolves. At all times, we have things like 1 to 2 packs on our farm or adjacent to our farm. And during that springtime, when we're calving, we will lose from 1 to maybe 5 calves a year due to kills. When there is a verified kill, meaning that when a calf is actually found, and the important point is that that's rare for us, that we're able to call in the feds, and they will come and trap as much of the pack that they can. And we are compensated for the loss of that calf. Other times of the year, the wolves don't cause us as much problem because as the calves grow, they become bigger and faster and harder for the wolves to catch them. We do have miscellaneous animals that prey. We have coyotes around, but they're insignificant to calves. And bear don't cause us any problems, but it's the wolves that are continually with us. They are with us year after year after year. After John Hart, our trapper, comes in and traps, it's like a vacuum on the farm. The density on my farm, in my county, in the surrounding counties, has the highest density of wolves in the world. In the world. And when I found out that fact, it scared the pants off of me to know that I am right in the middle of this. And how I can continue to keep farming surprises me, knowing that fact. And so, but we've done it, and we've done it successfully. And we will try to keep doing that in the future. And we're here to talk about the Endangered Species Act, and I expect that to be a benefit for me in the future. At, I guess, I don't know if it's been a benefit for me at this point, but if there's a change, it'll help me a little bit more, and so I'm hoping for a change.
Okay, and I'm looking forward to hearing more about, you know, exactly how you handle the wolves and how you handle your cattle to avoid depredation. So we'll hear more about that in a bit. Now let's hear from Adrian Weideman, who's with the Wisconsin DNR. And Adrian, tell us what you do.
Yes, I'm a mammalian ecologist, which means work mostly with mammals in the state and mostly non-game or non-hunted mammals. And a big part of what I do is manage the state wolf population, which in Wisconsin has been doing very well. We're part of the Great Lakes wolf population, which was delisted from the federal list of endangered species in 2007, but because of various lawsuits is now back as an endangered species in Wisconsin and Michigan. It's listed as a threatened species currently in Minnesota. That means that in Wisconsin and Michigan, we have very limited authority for any kind of lethal controls. Our wolf population went from zero wolves in 1960, slowly coming back about 1975 as Minnesota wolves started to spread back into Wisconsin, and we were greatly helped and assisted by the Endangered Species Act. It's been a real benefit for recovering wolves in Wisconsin. The 1973 Endangered Species Act listed wolves in 1974, and it was shortly after that they started appearing in the state, and we started a formal monitoring program. We've been doing that now for 30 years, and while I'm talking about that, I want to let everybody know, too, that this next week is Wolf Awareness Week, which is an event that we promote in Wisconsin but throughout the country on educating people about wolves, and in the back of these posters we always feature some things going on with wolves, and this year we're celebrating 30 years of continuous wolf monitoring in the state of Wisconsin. So it's probably the longest ongoing state wolf monitoring program anywhere in the country. And during that time period, the wolf population has grown from 25 wolves to about 650 wolves last winter. So we've had a tremendous growth in our population. We've been very much benefited by the Endangered Species Act. But we're at a point where we're well beyond a recovered population. And the kind of things that David talks about are things we're seeing more and more every year in Wisconsin. Prior to 2000, we have less than half a dozen farms in Wisconsin with depredation problems. The last couple of years, it's been 30 or more farms that are having depredation problems. And we do use a variety of non-lethal methods to try to get wolves off of farms and to deal with depredation problems, but we do need to have tools of being able to do lethal controls. When we were delisted in 2007-2008, we had 85 wolves that were removed from farms and depredation sites, combination of federal trappers, also landowner permits and landowner authorities. When they were delisted, we could allow landowners to shoot wolves in the act of attacking pets and livestock on people's property, and we could allow federal trappers to trap and remove problem wolves. We don't have that kind of authority right now. So they are, again, a listed species, and we're dealing with some very difficult problems right now trying to manage that population. And we do need to have wolves again delisted in the near future so that we can have the tools we need to manage the wolves in the state.
Thank you, Adrian Weideman from the Wisconsin DNR. And now we'll ask Bob Irvin to talk about himself, what he does, and why you're here.
Sure, thank you. I'm the Senior Vice President for Conservation Programs at Defenders of Wildlife in Washington, D.C., and by training I'm a forester and a lawyer. I started out on the path of righteousness and then went astray. But at Defenders of Wildlife, I oversee our conservation advocacy programs, which includes our work on wolf conservation. Defenders of Wildlife has been around since 1947. We have over a million members and activists, and we focus on the protection of biodiversity and the habitats that sustain that biodiversity. And we have a special place for our work on large predators, and particularly on wolves. The wolf is on our logo. And We've been involved for a long time in efforts to restore wolves throughout the United States, not only in the Great Lakes states, but also in the Northern Rockies, in the Southwest, Mexican wolf populations, and in the Southeast for red wolf populations as well. Listening to David talk about being a rancher in the middle of the highest density of wolf populations reminded me of something that occurred a few years ago when I was on a trip to Zimbabwe, and I was out driving along in the northeast part of the country, and I saw these villagers out filling in a hole in what seemed to be the middle of nowhere. And I asked the guide I was with, what are they doing? And he said, well, every night the elephants come and dig up the water. Whoops, that was good. The elephants come and turn over the water. No, they dig up the, pardon me, the water lines, and the villagers have to come out every day and fill it back in to maintain the water supply for the village. And that really struck home to me, because what it said to me was that you know, it's easy to look at wildlife from a perspective of, oh, they ought to be there and everybody ought to be happy to have them there and just leave them alone, when you don't live there. When you live there, your perspective is different. But what I've also found is the folks who live with wildlife often have the greatest appreciation for them as they work out ways to coexist. And so I think David's story of being able to run a successful operation in the midst of wolf country is really an inspiring one, and one that I'm looking forward to hearing more about. Defenders has recognized the need to work with landowners for many years. We have established a compensation program where we compensate livestock operators for livestock loss to wolves or bears, any endangered predator species. We have done that for a number of years and continue to do so where those animals are listed under the Endangered Species Act. And in addition to that, we have funded a proactive conservation program and continue to do that, where we work with livestock operators to develop proactive methods to head off conflicts with wolves and grizzly bears and other animals. So things like guard dogs and fladry, which is basically flagging that you hang on wires around where your sheep are, and the wolves it operates kind of like a scarecrow with them. They don't like going around it. Range riders and other techniques like that. So we've done a lot of that. And then in addition to our cooperative efforts, when necessary, you know, we are hard-hitting advocates. We've advocated in the Congress and with the executive branch for years for wolf restoration and for measures to protect wolves, to bring about their recovery, and when necessary, we've gone to court to do that. And I don't want to talk too long, but I'm sure as we go on, I'll talk about our efforts in the Northern Rockies and in the Great Lakes, why we view the two situations differently, and why our actions have been different.
Yeah, we want to hear about that. And I'm going to skip ahead here a little bit, because you've all done a good job of summarizing what some of my questions were initially. So, David, I'm going to ask you to talk a little bit more about how the wolves affect your farming operation and how you handle that. Bob just mentioned a few things that are done. What do you do to protect your cattle?
Wolves affect us financially and psychologically. You know, we're a low margin business. We need to sell a lot of calves and make a few dollars, and that's the way we do it. And so losing calves is my income, and in our situation, money goes to the family. It goes to the farm first, and then we take money comes out of the family coffers. And so, if we have losses are the margin that we would like to have a little extra. So that generally comes out of our family living expenses. And so psychologically, that hurts. So in order to protect ourselves, we have different means of doing that. Bob had mentioned the guard dogs, and we tried that. It didn't work for us. Guard dogs tended to come back for our family pets, so that situation doesn't work. Fencing would be great, but fencing is too expensive on a 1,200-acre farm. So we use other means. In Minnesota, we're able to trap the wolves. I can't, but the feds come in and can trap when I have a verified kill. And so I consider the trapper my friend. I have other friends that I use to help manage the wolves. And they aren't necessarily people. Wolves have mange. Mange is a mite that infects wolves. Wolves touch each other. The wolf loses its hair. He eventually dies of hypothermia. And so I consider mange an effective means of keeping the density down in my area. Parvovirus. Parvovirus is a respiratory disease that pups pick up. Your family pups can get parvovirus. It affects young animals because they have an immature immune system. And so litter size is greatly diminished. It is unusual to see large litters of wolves in Minnesota. We saw a litter of 6 pups like 3 years ago. That was extraordinary and fascinating to see. But just 2 or 3 pups is kind of the normal for us. Another friend I have is beaver. We like nature. We maintain nature. We need a lot of beaver. Beaver are a good foodstuff for the wolves when our calves are being born. When we catch wolves that have killed calves, we see a lot of beaver meat in them. And so that's kind of a big main stuff, foodstuff for them before their fawn are born in June and July. By the time June and July comes, our calves are getting a little bit bigger, and the fawn are easy prey for the wolves, and so we're thankful for deer. Minnesota has a large population of deer, and so there are a lot of fawn, but that large population of deer has shown now to be increasing the pack size. Pack size increases density, which scares me, and so I'm not sure. Deer are good and bad, and so there's those kinds of things. I think those are the main things that I do to use physically and emotionally to help manage the wolves in our place.
Well, that's fascinating, and we'll get to some questions in a minute. I want to ask Adrian to give us a quick explanation of how wolves function in the ecosystem, and what I'm getting at here is it, I don't know what this means, is it a keystone species? Does it really affect, because I've heard of, you know, things that it does in the Rocky Mountains that have benefited a lot of other species. Does it work that way in Wisconsin?
Well, we haven't done nearly the level of research and that has been done in Yellowstone and some of the western states, but we are starting to do some of that kind of research, trying to look at what the effects are of wolves on ecosystem. And just some of the preliminary things we're finding is that in cedar swamps, we have a greater diversity, a higher abundance of understory plants than we do where they are in the middle of wolf packs and outside of wolf pack areas where they're more heavy grazing and browsing by deer. We see that the distribution and abundance of deer probably are varied somewhat in the landscape. I've heard from some of our fisheries biologists that they're having less problems with trout streams that in the past they used to have a lot of problems with streams being plugged up by beaver, too high a beaver population, and the predation of wolves on those beaver, keeping the beaver population at lower levels, so the streams are free-flowing, and so they're having less problems with the trout. We are getting our deer population under better control, and up until recently, our biggest problem with ungulates has been trying to control or manage our deer population. I just want to point out 3 unique features about wolves in Wisconsin and the Great Lakes region. In the Great Lakes region, it's the only place in the lower 48 states that wolves were never completely extirpated. Plus, another feature is they were never reintroduced back into this region or in the 3 state areas. There was a minor reintroduction attempted in Michigan in 1974, which was unsuccessful, but all the recovery of wolves in this region is due to the natural recovery of wolves. The other thing we don't have in our region compared to the western states is we don't have public grazing on public forest lands. So where we have depredation problems, it's much more clustered in these private farms, private pasture land areas. We don't have it occurring across the national forest. But, yeah, we are starting to explore and find some of these similar relationships. We suspect that Wolves are going to have some impact on forest regeneration. We've heard from a lot of foresters in recent years with our high deer population that they're seeing very little regeneration of a lot of our important forest trees. And we're hoping that the growth of our wolf population, having a higher population, will improve that. But we are looking at more of those things, and we probably will find more of those things.
Isn't that interesting? Okay. Now, Bob, you're going to do the meat and potatoes work for us here and tell us why the wolves are on and off the endangered species list more times than you can count, and how they got divided up into these different population segments and so on.
Well, the Endangered Species Act has been a remarkably successful law, and there's probably no greater example of the success than wolf recovery, both here in the Great Lakes and in the Northern Rockies. But how that plays out in terms of getting wolves off the list is a little more complicated than that. Basically, when a species gets listed, there are a number of factors that get considered, including its population numbers, but what are all the threats to it, and what are the other regulatory mechanisms or laws that are in place that either help it or hurt it. And they take all those things into account before they put a species on the list, and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is supposed to take all of those things into account before they take a species off the list as well. What happened in the Great Lakes is as David and Adrian have both described, there has been a tremendous success in terms of the number of wolves. But in addition to that, the other factors that come into play have also worked in the Great Lakes, which is that you have state fish and wildlife agencies that work closely with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service on wolf recovery, have taken actions to promote wolf recovery, and most importantly, to ensure the continued recovery of wolves once they're taken off the list. And as a result of all of those things, when wolves were taken off the list in the Great Lakes, Defenders of Wildlife supported that action. Now, not everyone in the environmental community did. There are groups that sued challenging the action because they disagreed that the management plans in place and that the numbers of wolves were sufficient to constitute recovery and allow delisting under the Endangered Species Act. But Defenders of Wildlife took a different view of that. The groups that sued were successful in getting the wolves in the Great Lakes to be relisted, at least for a while, on a procedural violation that the Fish and Wildlife Service had not allowed adequate notice and public comment on the wolf delisting plan for the Great Lakes. And so that's why wolves are back on the list in the Great Lakes. The comment period has been taking place, and I fully expect that once again the service will delist wolves. There will undoubtedly be additional litigation after that, but I think that the odds of this delisting holding are probably much greater this time around. The situation in the Northern Rockies is different. There has been, again, a tremendous recovery in terms of numbers of wolves in the Northern Rockies, but there is some concern that the targets that were set for delisting, which were set many years ago, are themselves not adequate to ensure that wolves stay in a place where they don't have to be listed again. And in particular, there are two main concerns that we have with the delisting. Number one is that we don't believe that the state management plans that are in place are adequate. What happened is that the Bush administration proposed to delist all wolves in the Northern Rockies except for Wyoming, because Wyoming has a state law that says that in 95% of the state, wolves are treated as predators and can be shot on sight. And neither the Bush administration nor the Obama administration could swallow hard enough to say that that was an adequate state management plan. But what they did do was to say, well, Idaho and Montana's plans are better, and so we're going to delist wolves in those two states. The problem with that is that they're making a decision to delist a biological population that spans the Northern Rockies Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, parts of Utah, Oregon, Washington. They're taking that population and they're saying we're only going to make a decision on part of it based on political boundaries. And the Endangered Species Act doesn't allow that, in our view. And it appears to be also the view of the federal judge in Montana who is hearing the case that we filed challenging the delisting. The states of Idaho and Montana both have plans in place that would sharply reduce the numbers of wolves in those states. Idaho plans to reduce the number of wolves in the state by about half of what the current population is. And under their state law, what the state law actually says, they can take it down to the absolute minimum of 150 wolves in Idaho from a population of around 1,000 right now. And so we don't think that those plans are adequate. And then the other part of this is that if you're going to have continued success of wolf recovery in the Northern Rockies, just as in the Great Lakes, you have to have some connectivity among the populations. You can't just create, you know, a pack of wolves here and then separate it by many, many miles and then a pack of wolves there and hope to have any genetic exchange. You have to have a population that's interacting not only within the Northern Rockies but with the larger wolf populations in Canada if it's going to stay healthy for the long term. And we believe that under the configuration of the population currently in the Northern Rockies and certainly under the state management plans does not provide for the necessary connectivity to ensure their continued recovery. By contrast, in the Great Lakes states, there is connection with the larger wolf populations in Canada, and again, that's a reason for why we view the two delistings differently.
Okay, and we'll get to audience questions after one more round from me. And David, I'd like to ask you about this Neospora. When I called and asked you to be on this panel, you told me about something I'd never heard of before, which is Neospora. Tell us about that.
Neospora, N-E-O-S-P-O-R-A. I call it Neospora. Some people call it Neospora. It's a protozoan parasite that travels through the bloodstream of coyotes, wolves, your family pet, and now my cattle. The food trail is this. The wolf has the Neospora. He poops on some grass and drops some oocytes or eggs on the grass. My cows eat the eggs. The cow goes over the water stream over here, or a swamp, or our lake, and drinks out of it and poops or pees in there. And so that transmits it to the next cow. And down the line, Neospora causes reduced milk production in my cow, which means she's giving less milk to her calf, which means a smaller calf, which means less income for me. The worst case scenario of Neospora is that it causes abortion. It's an abortive agent. We have spontaneous abortions in our cows normally. We'll lose from several to five, six, seven, eight abortions every year. We are getting onto the higher end of normal for abortions. We have blood tested our cows. Our cows have Neospora. I said Neospora is the worst case scenario. It's in a sense it is, but it goes beyond that. There's a term called Neospora abortion storms. Google that when you get home and see what that tells you. An abortion storm is just what it says. It's when a farmer will lose from tens to hundreds of fetuses in a single year. And that's the worst case scenario that I see. I don't mind losing four or five calves every spring to wolf kills. That's a few thousand dollars out of my family income. I cannot afford an abortion storm. That would put me out of, well, almost put me out of business. And then I've been patient with wolves. I've lived with wolves, and we've been successful with wolves. But I think that would turn into war because that would destroy my livelihood. I farm because I grew up in it. It's in my blood. It's a good business for me, and my family enjoys what we do. We've done well with nature. If you saw that the National Park Program on PBS last week, there was a quote in one of the first or second episodes that said, and I wrote it down, it says, nature is never wrong. Nature is never wrong. When it comes to wolves and cows and Neosporin, I question that. It's been bugging me all week to try to put that sentence into perspective. And maybe it just pertains to national parks. I'm just at a loss for words. Neospora scares the pants off of me.
Thank you. Okay, Adrian, I'm going to ask you one more question, then we'll open it up to everyone else. And that is, talk a bit about human acceptance of wolves, because that seems to be a key factor, and I don't know whether you feel able to contrast human acceptance in the Midwest versus the Rockies, but that would be the gist of my question.
I think over time, human acceptance has really improved in our region. Since the 1980s, we've had major efforts at wolf educational programs teaching people about wolves, such as Wolf Awareness Week. The Timberwolf Alliance was formed in 1987, and the Timberwolf Information Network in 1990 to help us with education. And just based on illegal kills of wolves that have died that we knew the cause of mortality of radio-collared wolves, back in the 1980s when wolves are just starting to recolonize Wisconsin, 60% of those that died from illegal kill, being shot by people mostly. Some trapped, but 60% died from illegal kill. In the 1990s, that dipped down to only 20%. At the same time, we had these major educational efforts. So we feel that that was benefiting the wolf population, that people were less likely to illegally kill wolves. But what we're seeing now in the 2000s is those illegal kills are starting to creep up. And in year 2006, that year, two-thirds of radio-collared wolves that died were illegally killed. And that was a year before they were federally delisted. And I think so that's perhaps one indication of level of human tolerance. We are starting to see an increase in illegal kill. And whether that means we're seeing a backlash toward this higher wolf population or just the fact that wolves are living in so many more places where there are a lot more people, that the original wolves were living in the most wild, remote parts of the state, so there is less opportunity for people to kill wolves. But we are seeing an increase in illegal kill. The attitude surveys in general have shown good support for wolves statewide, but what we are seeing is in areas where wolves are living, people are living close to wolves, there we get more negative attitudes. And as the population spreads over more of the state and more people are living with wolves, there is a risk that we are going to lose tolerance of those people. And for us, it's real critical to have tools in place to improve that tolerance. And when we were delisted, we could give landowners permits to shoot wolves when they had depredation problems. We could allow landowners to shoot wolves coming on their property. And we sent government trappers in to trap wolves that had killed livestock or killed pets at people's homes. That seemed to really improve people's ease of living with wolves. Now that they're more restricted in being able to do anything about problem wolves, I think that makes people very uneasy. So I think at this point, with the population where it's at, we really need to have flexible tools to maintain a good management system for them. I think in general, because wolves did recolonize these areas on their own, weren't reintroduced, there's probably less of a resentment toward the government. But we constantly still have this myth floating around, and people constantly saying, why did you bring wolves in, or why did you bring those animals into the state? And we constantly have to tell people, we did not bring wolves in. But that's still a common myth, and of all the educational challenges we have, that's probably our biggest one, educating people that wolves were not brought into the state.
Well, you don't have that advantage of being able to say that in the Northern Rockies, right, Bob? Could you just talk briefly about acceptance there?
Sure. Because wolves were extirpated from the Northern Rockies, there was a fair amount of hostility towards wolf reintroduction. That's probably an understatement. But one of the things over the years that even some of the most vociferous opponents of wolf reintroduction in the Congress finally figured out that they were better off to reintroduce wolves and use the flexibility of the Endangered Species Act to manage them than they were to wait for the inevitable return of wolves from from Canada into the Northern Rockies and have them treated as fully protected endangered species. And so the Endangered Species Act itself provided a lot of the flexibility that that livestock operators needed to deal with wolves in the Northern Rockies. And you have a region where it's somewhat ironic in that you have a lot of folks who do graze on public lands, run private livestock operations by purchasing federal grazing permits, and yet are extremely hostile to government interference in their lives. And, you know, I mean, nobody likes the government to interfere in your life at all, but there is a little bit of irony when your livelihood is dependent on federal land that you're resistant to using that federal land for anything other than your own livelihood. And so the fact is that the public lands are multiple-use lands, and part of the multiple use of the public lands is wildlife. I think what we're seeing in the Northern Rockies is a lessening of hostility toward wolves overall, both as the demographics of the region change, as people start to realize that there actually is some economic benefit. The number one reason people go to Yellowstone National Park is to see wolves, the surveys show. And so all of those people traveling and spending money on the way to the park and on the way out of the park are bringing benefits to the economy of the region. I think that programs like Defenders Compensation Program have been useful in helping people learn to live with wolves, even if they don't necessarily love wolves, and so that's been important also. But there is and will continue to be hostility, and ultimately the success of the delisting of wolves will go a long way toward determining how people feel about them, and that's why we want to see the delisting done right. We want to see it done in accordance with the law, and we want to see it be a long-term success rather than a short-term political fix.
Okay, well, let's find out what you guys are wondering. And as you know, the SEJ members get to go first, and you are you start, because you had a question a long time ago. Huh. Oh, go ahead. Okay, for the tape, I'm going to repeat the question. Are you compensated, David Radaich, for what you lose, and is there no cure for Neosporin?
I'm compensated for verified kills. It has to be an animal killed or remained, and 99% killed. A calf in the fall is worth $500 to $600 for me when I go to sell it, and that's what I get for it, $500 to $600. Cure for Neosporin, there is no cure. There was a vaccine for Neospora that is hot. It'll cause abortions itself. I have to learn to deal with it. And it's spread by the wolves, so either kill the wolves, kill the coyotes, kill my family pets, or else I have to manage how I feed my animals. We started to block off our water accesses. We blocked off our lake. We blocked off a couple of our man-made ponds. We built a deep well for $6,000, bought a propane generator for $5,000 to supply fresh water out of the ground. You know, we used to do it the natural way, nature's way, and it's not nature anymore if that's what we have to do. But water comes from underground where it's pure. So that's the philosophy we have to do. And so as we can cash flow in the future, we'll dig more wells to keep cows away from water. That's the only thing I can see of controlling it, you know, and get rid of cows that abort, which we do anyhow, but, you know, sell them because they're infected.
There.
Yeah. I'm Urban Lehner, TPN, the Progressive Farmer. I wonder if you could explain the connectivity question in a little more detail. You said that the Great Lakes states have allowed connectivity into the Canadian packs.
Well, okay, Bob Rubin, a better explanation of why connectivity is important.
For the continued recovery of wolves, it's going to be important for there to be adequate genetic exchange, in particular in the Northern Rockies where they were reintroduced. And so there was a fairly finite number of wolves brought in, and all of the wolves since then have sprung from that limited genetic pool. So if you want to have a healthy wolf population, you've got to have more connectivity with the wild populations in Canada. And the more that you reduce the numbers of wolves and restrict them in area, which is what the state management plans in Idaho and Montana will do, the less likely you are to be able to have the free-flowing genetic exchange with wild populations in Canada. Because of state management in the Great Lakes and the geography of the region, that's less of a problem here, and there is more connectivity.
I guess my question was, what did the Great Lakes do that's so good to keep connectivity?
The question is, what did the Great Lakes do that is so good to keep connectivity? I think they just had a more progressive vision of how to manage wolves. That actually, to the states have wild wolves have been listed, have cooperated with the Fish and Wildlife Service, have actually managed habitat and in a way to promote the number of wolves, and we've seen a growth in the number of wolves. And more importantly, the state plans for managing wolves, once they come off the list in the Great Lakes, are designed to continue that recovery, to continue allowing wolf populations to thrive, albeit with necessary control to deal with problem situations. But it's just a more progressive management. By contrast, you have a state like Idaho, where the state legislature has passed a law declaring it to be the state policy to remove wolves from the state of Idaho, and I quote, by any means necessary, unquote. And you have the governor of Idaho, Butch Otter, who proudly proclaimed to the state that he wanted to be the first in line to purchase a wolf hunting permit when the state opened up the hunting season. He actually didn't do that because he had to attend a funeral, but he still made that boast.
Adrian, would you want to add anything to that?
Well, I think part of it, too, would be just the geography of the region, is that we've got contiguous northern forest that runs from Ontario through northern Wisconsin, or through northern Minnesota, through northern Wisconsin, and into Michigan, with no major gaps through that area, whereas I think one of the things you have in the Rocky Mountains is you've got mountains which separate areas of suitable habitat and areas in between that are less suitable habitat and more developed areas. So I think that's probably a big part of the difference. It's just the geography of the region.
There?
Frances Backhouse from Victoria, British Columbia, a freelancer. Given the importance of the Canadian wolf populations in the Rockies, what you call the Northern Rockies, what we call Southern Rockies.
Right. Everybody has their own perspective.
Yeah. What do you think about British Columbia and Alberta's efforts on both regulatory side and management side?
Okay, go ahead, just repeat.
The question is, given the importance of Canadian wolf populations, what are our views on wolf management in British Columbia and Alberta? First, let me preface by saying I'm not intimately familiar with the wolf management policies. We do have a one-person office in Canmore, Alberta, where we have worked on in particular wolf management in Alberta to try to promote conservation policies. I know we've had some issues there with the way that the province has managed wolves, but I'm not familiar enough to be able to give you a comprehensive answer on that. But I guess the one thing I would say is that there are a lot more wolves in Canada than there are in the Northern Rockies, and so I would say there's a bigger margin for error.
Yes, and the white cherry. Sure.
I'm Ann Menard. I'm a transcript scholar in environmental journalism at CB Board. And I've been interested in wolves for a long time, and the challenge always seems to be human acceptance of wolves. And I wonder, is there any indication that wolves can learn to live with people? And I guess is there enough space for them to live in where they don't have to be on ranches? Is there enough natural prey species out there where they don't have to prey on cows? And if so, are there management strategies to help guide them toward those decisions?
You're looking at Bob, but I think Adrian should have a first crack at that question. The question is... Adrian was searching the brain there. Repeat the question briefly.
Sure. Are there ways wolves can become more adapted to living with people, and are there ways people can be more accepting of having wolves? And I think there certainly are. I think the Great Lakes region is a good example in a lot of ways. When I was going to school in college in the 1970s, wolves were an extinct species, and at the time the feeling was Wisconsin didn't have wilderness areas, was no longer wild enough to support wolf populations, and the picture we had of wolves at the time was a species that only could live in these pristine wilderness areas. And but so much of that is just human attitudes. If we allow wolves to live in places, they can live most anywhere. They're given adequate protection where there's a reasonable prey base. In places in Europe, wolves live in places with much higher human density than what we have in the United States. In Wisconsin, we've got more deer hunters in Wisconsin than Wyoming has people, and yet Wyoming, has less of a wolf population than Wisconsin does, and is almost twice as big as Wisconsin. I think people can become more accepting of wolves, but I think at the same time, as agencies, we have to be responsible for where do we want to encourage wolves. Are there places that are more suitable where conflicts are more likely to occur and other places where they're less likely to occur? And what we do see is that when wolves live in wild land areas, not necessarily wilderness, but places that are managed for forestry purposes, that are hunted, that are trapped, they're mostly in forest conditions or other wild land conditions, but where you've got lack of agricultural land, in those places there's very minimum conflict. But when you get mixtures of forest land and farmland, especially when there's a high interspersion, I think you have high risks of conflict. And wolves can certainly live in those areas, but do we want to encourage wolves in those areas? And I think we have to have tools in place to encourage wolves in a place where there's good, suitable habitat for them, same time discourage and keep populations at low levels in areas where there's just high risks of conflict. But wolves have adapted. They've spread across states like Wisconsin, Michigan, where 34 years ago we didn't think wolves could live. So they certainly can adapt.
David Radnaich, would you like to share your perspective on that?
You make an interesting point. Wolves are turning into just like bear. They're becoming a nuisance. This year in Ely, Minnesota, there's a wolf that hangs around the town going through people's trash. Down in Cross Lake, Minnesota, there was a wolf living in the city limits. They are adapting. I talk about my farm, how large my farm is. Wolves are right behind my house, just a few hundred feet. My wife went to town on Monday, and a skinky wolf, I should say a mangy wolf, drove right in front of her into the horse pen. They are used to us, and they're becoming more and more adapted. And that's part of the problem. As wolf numbers become larger, they're just naturally moving out. They're heading down into southern Minnesota now. There are just so many, they just move.
A quick follow-up, though. If wolves were, say, restricted, to areas where there were least likely to be conflicts between wolves and people, would there be enough area to maintain the kinds of populations that we think are healthy?
Adrian.
I think we do. As question as far as are there enough areas to support healthy wolf populations, I think there are. And the forest lands we have across northern Wisconsin, the public and industrial forest lands, areas that are managed mainly for forest production, there's within those areas we can maintain healthy, viable populations. The vast majority of our wolves live in those kind of places. Some live in areas where there's mixed forest farmland, but the vast majority live in heavily forested areas. And some of our modeling of wolf populations suggests that they seem to avoid areas where there's farmland. So the wolves don't necessarily want to go to those places. I think they only settle into those areas when the other areas of suitable habitat are mostly occupied. But I think, potentially, I think there's places in Pennsylvania and eastern states that could support healthy wolf population in heavily forested areas.
Another question? Yes, back there.
Focused on wolf ecology and management. And then I lived in Alaska for a while, which there isn't a lot of agricultural land, and they're not
Bob, can you recap that question real briefly?
Sure. And I'll take a crack at it, but Adrian probably has a better perspective on it. The question is experience with predator control programs has shown that wolf populations will, in the space of 2 to 5 years, rebound to their original levels. And so, in a way, isn't it just sort of a futile effort to keep doing that? And wouldn't the money be better spent on other programs to reduce conflict other than predator control? You mentioned the situation in Alaska, and that's something that my organization, Defenders of Wildlife, has been heavily involved in, is the effort to stop the aerial gunning of wolves in Alaska. And it's not because we are, you know, an animal rights organization or anything like that. It's because we believe that program is unscientific, that the purpose of that program is actually to artificially inflate game numbers, primarily for the benefit of out-of-state hunters in Alaska, by going out and shooting wolves from airplanes and helicopters. And the former governor, Sarah Palin, was a vociferous proponent of that, and the current governor appears to continue to support that program as well. And so we're going to continue fighting over it, and indeed are working to pass a piece of federal legislation called Protect America's Wildlife Act, the PAW Act, that would close the loopholes in the federal airborne hunting law. But I mean, wolves, you know, wolves or any other wildlife species are going to respond, their birth rates and all of that are going to respond to the type of control. One of the best studies ever is, of course, the one from the Great Lakes, the Isle Royale moose-wolf population studies, and how they respond to each other as one population grows and falls. And anybody that ever took wildlife biology would undoubtedly have studied that. I think there is a role for controlling problem situations, and will often include lethal control of wolves or other predators. And our view is that as long as it's done in a scientifically defensible manner, that's what we want to see. We want to see scientific wildlife management. There are other things that can be done as well, and that's why my organization supports all of the proactive work we do, and why ultimately we also step in to pay compensation to livestock operators, because there are other ways to reduce conflict, and we think it's going to require a mix of all of those methods to reach the point where, in fact, people and wolves can coexist.
Adrian, let me ask. What I heard there was, aren't there better ways of spending money to reduce conflict?
I think I want to answer that question. I want to say a few things about the self-regulatory nature of wolf populations. They do self-regulate, but they regulate. The basis for self-regulation is a prey base. And if the prey base are wild ungulates and wild herbivores, that's what they use to regulate their populations. The problem is when the prey base are also cattle and sheep and goats, that's going to cause a higher population, a population that's not highly accepted. As far as keeping numbers down and they're repopulating, in areas where you've got just a few farms in large wildland complexes, you can't reduce the wolf population there to have much of an impact. You can remove the individual problem wolves from farms, but you can't reduce the population. On the other hand, in these marginal areas of wolf habitat, mixed forest, farmland, where wolves are only living there because of the best habitats already occupied, I think you can control their numbers and keep them at lower numbers in those areas where they're causing higher conflict anyway. As far as,
By controlling the problem wolves?
Some situations you want to control the whole wolf population where in areas. Not every area is suitable for having wolves.
Through hunting or trapping?
Through hunting, trapping, landowner controls, proactive controls by government trappers, a combination of these various tools. I'm not saying that one or the other would be really cool, but there are areas we want to keep wolf populations to very low levels, and other areas we want the population to fluctuate more naturally. I don't remember
fencing.
As far as spending money on the most effective methods. I think there's a whole toolbox of methods. In some situations, lethal controls are the most effective methods. In some situations, fencing might be. We've done some experimentation using dog shock collars on wolves, where we have set up a device on the farms that and have put shock collars on wolves so that when they get within a quarter mile of the farm, they get shocked to try to create pockets where the wolves just avoid going. I think there's a variety of things, and we need to test more of those things. In some situations, fencing might be 1,200 acres. You're not going to be able to fence that with 10-foot-high fencing, but if you've got just a 40-acre area where you're raising sheep in the middle of a national forest, yes, fencing would be the most effective way instead of going in there and killing all the wolves. So it varies, and I think it depends on the situation and the circumstances.
David, would you like to comment on that?
Fencing is too expensive for my aspect. I think there's psychological things here. Just by delisting the wolf takes the psychological pressure off of the pet owner, and it takes the psychological pressure off of the farmer to know that he can do some controlling. In Minnesota, up to this date, only 189 wolves have been destroyed in 2009. So it's really not that many out of 3,000 or 4,000. Mm-hmm. So if the farmers could do some of that themselves, that would help. You would have less public pressure from the farmer to control for wolf, whatever you want to call it. But that is huge. You know, and this thing about the wolf trapping season, people are afraid of a wolf hunting season, and that's psychological too. It's psychological from the side of the people that want to protect the wolves, and I think deer hunters are afraid that the wolves are getting their deer, but that's okay. I believe in survival of the fittest. But when Mr. Macho goes out there and says, "I want a trophy wolf," there are no trophy wolves in the lower 48 states. They've got mange, their hair is thin, the wolves are smaller. If you want pelts, you go up into Canada or Alaska, where the real wolves are. You know, and you see a wolf that's freshly killed. This guy's gonna shoot his wolf. There'll be 100 wood ticks coming off that thing. And that guy's going to say, "Ooh, you know, what did I shoot that for?" And say, just the psychological effect from all sides will downplay the situation, I believe.
Any more questions before we get to repeats? Okay, go ahead.
I have another clarification question to ask. Just make sure that I heard and understood you correctly about the state of the laws in Idaho and Montana. I thought you said that Wyoming, Idaho. But I think you said that in Wyoming, the law says in 95% of the state you can shoot a wolf on sight, and then in Idaho the state has a law that makes it state policy to eliminate wolves by any means possible. And yet the federal government allowed Wyoming or Idaho to delist, but not Wyoming, but aren't those two pretty comparable?
Right. The question is, don't Idaho and Wyoming basically have the same policy of eliminating wolves, and why is it that the federal government found that Idaho was adequate and not Wyoming? Good question. That's basically one of the questions we're posing in our lawsuit challenging the delisting, because in fact, what Idaho has done is the state legislature has declared in law that the state policy is to eliminate wolves by any means necessary. But the state Fish and Game Agency recognizes that there's no way in the world that if that they follow that policy that they will ever get state management of wolves again. And so they've kind of looked the other way and said, "Oh, well, that's what those crazies in the state legislature have said, but here's our state plan, and we're going to manage wolves to about 500 wolves. That's the population we'll have, which is, as I said earlier, about half of the number that are in the state now. And we regard that as inadequate. And so that's what they did. Montana has a more progressive plan, but also calls for a pretty significant reduction of wolves in the state. And unfortunately, Interior Secretary Salazar looked at this, decided to adopt the previous administration's proposal and say that Idaho and Montana's plans were adequate, and therefore we're going to delist. And you know, we were stunned by that decision, to say the least. We thought, you know, we had just sent a letter to the secretary shortly before, saying that, you know, there is a path to delisting that will return management of wolves to the states in the Northern Rockies. We want to work with you to do that. The current plan won't do it, but we want to work with you to make that happen. And you know, he ignored us. And so as a result, we were forced to go to court to challenge it. It was the first one of the first lawsuits filed against this administration on an environmental issue. And we moved for a preliminary injunction about a month ago to stop the wolf hunts that were about to take place in Idaho and Montana, again, not because we're anti-hunting, but because, in our view, the delisting was illegal, and therefore any state hunts were illegal as a result of that. The federal judge decided not to to issue a preliminary injunction to stop the hunts, but he did indicate in his ruling that he believes that ultimately we will prevail on our claims, and that which is indicating that eventually, probably sometime next summer, he's going to rule that the delisting was illegal. Once again, Northern Rockies wolves will be relisted, and this administration will get a chance to try to do it right.
I was wondering, I think you mentioned Pennsylvania, that you could see, and wouldn't wolves survive in upstate New York? And why isn't there someone demanding that the wolves be either reintroduced or protected by the Endangered Species Act in those other places, or in any place where they used to exist? I don't understand that.
I think your organization was recommending that they be reintroduced. Now, was that a workshop that your organization put on about 10 years ago looking at that issue?
Yep. It was before I was at Defenders of Wildlife, but I know that Defenders has in the past been a proponent of wolf restoration in the Northeast as well. I think that there was a decision made that there were a lot of factors that complicated it politically. It wasn't really clear that the prey base was sufficient for a successful reintroduction at the time. But it's something that we continue to look at. We have a publication available on our website, www.defenders.org, called Places for Wolves, that lays out our vision for wolf recovery across the country, and that includes the Northeast. And Kat Lazaroff, who is here from our communications department, is distributing a fact sheet we put together on the Northern Rockies wolf situation.
Well, let's have a quick summary from each of our panelists, and thank you very much, everyone, for coming. Let's have Adrian start by looking to the future for the Great Lakes wolves.
Well, I think in the Great Lakes region, we've benefited from the Endangered Species Act. We've benefited from having a residual population in Minnesota and being close to the Canadian populations, and we've benefited from recovery of our forest lands in the Great Lakes region after the cuttings that occurred in the 1900s, early 20th century. That wolves are doing very well. We're hoping in the near future they again are delisted from the federal government, and that the states can start taking over management. Issues such as whether there's hunting seasons or not hunting seasons, I think, is less critical than that we do get state management, that it can be more flexible, that we have more tools at hand to manage the wolf populations. One of the things that we don't have, Bob talked about the flexibility of the Endangered Species Act for reintroduced populations. Unfortunately, for natural recovering populations, it's very strict. David has not had authority to be able to shoot wolves coming, attacking his livestock until the delisting occurred, whereas ranchers in Wyoming and Montana have had that authority since wolves have been reintroduced. So we need those kind of flexible management authorities so that we can manage our population. I think wolves are going to do very well in this region. I think the states are going to continue to be committed to managing and maintaining healthy populations throughout the Great Lakes area.
Okay, thank you. David, what are your hopes about wolves?
In my state, the wolf program is tremendously successful. The wolf has done better than what anybody's dream was. You know, I think it's time now to think about delisting them, and I think it's great that people from both sides of the aisle, the centrists, can get together and come up with a plan, and I guess that's my hope that something is done, so, because that would help me on the bottom end of the food chain to survive and to still be successful with what we're doing. So,
thank you. And Bob Urban.
Well, as I said at the outset, the recovery of wolves in the United States is truly one of our great conservation success stories under the Endangered Species Act, but it's not done yet. And we don't want to just say that wolves are recovered because there are a lot of them out there. We have to make sure that the recovery continues, that the protections that are in place at the state level will continue their recovery, that we work to reduce conflicts with landowners like David, because ultimately that's key to the success of wolf recovery as well. And so there's still a lot of work out there to be done, but I think that we are on the verge of being able to celebrate a tremendous conservation success, one that shows that we can have wolves and we can have successful farms and ranches as well.
Okay, now I'm supposed to remind you it's just an idea, jot down a couple of thoughts about the session so that when you get an email in the next week or so, you can give a nice complete feedback about the session. And I hope you'll all join us for lunch upstairs. I don't know what the layout is, but I would hope that we might be able to sit at a table and continue the discussion. So thank you very much to our panelists for being here.